in the face and in the groove, tech tales and funding plays. Welcome to Startup Jazz. Startup Jazz.
Welcome back to the bandstand, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Startup Jazz, the show where we break down the riffs, rhythms, and revolutions of the startup world. I'm George, and as always, I'm here with the sharpest mind in the room.
And I'm Michelle. George, you say that every week, but I appreciate the intro. Welcome, everyone, to episode 12. It's great to have you with us as we tune into the frequency of innovation and see who's hitting the right notes this week.
That's the name of the game, isn't it? It's all about finding that groove. You know, I was listening to John Coltrane's Giant Steps this morning. It's famous, or maybe infamous, for its incredibly complex and rapid chord changes. Musicians call it a rite of passage. You can't just follow the sheet music. You have to feel it, anticipate it, and improvise over this dizzying harmonic landscape. If you hesitate, you're lost.
And I have a feeling you're not just talking about music.
Never just talking about music. I think that's the perfect metaphor for the founders we're seeing today. They're not just playing the simple C major scale of build a product, find a customer. The market is throwing these wild, giant steps level chord progressions at them. New tech, shifting consumer behavior, global supply chains. And the great ones, the virtuosos, they don't just survive it, they thrive. They create something beautiful and new right in the middle of that complexity. It's breathtaking to watch.
It really is. And that ability to navigate complexity, to anticipate the next change before it happens, is exactly what ties our two main stories together today. We're going to be looking at two very different industries, but both are being redefined by founders who hear the music a little differently.
A perfect setup. So what's on the set list for our opening segment today?
First, we're diving into the world of hardcore robotics. A new company called Shuangji Dynamics just raised a massive angel round, nearly 100 million RMB. But the real story here is the founder, OD. He was the former head of the Inspire drone line at DJI, one of their most complex and technically advanced products. He's now taking that deep engineering expertise and applying it to four-legged industrial robots.
Ah, so we've got a virtuoso soloist leaving the world's most famous big band to start his own experimental quartet. That is a story I always want to hear. DJI is the Glenn Miller Orchestra of the drone world, impeccably engineered, massively popular, a true standard of excellence. When a lead player like that steps out on their own, you have to pay attention.
Exactly. We'll break down their core technology, which includes a special type of motor they've developed in-house, their go-to-market strategy with major industrial partners, and whether this DJI DNA can give them a real edge in a crowded field.
Love it. And for our second number?
We're shifting from hardware to high-end homes. We're looking at a fascinating trend piece from Entrepreneur magazine about how AI and augmented reality are fundamentally changing the luxury real estate market. It's an industry most people think of as old school, driven by handshakes and relationships.
The last bastion of the analog age.
You would think. But the article argues that the new leaders in this space are using predictive AI to identify properties before they even hit the market, and immersive AR to give buyers a true feel for a home from thousands of miles away. We'll discuss how this isn't just about efficiency. It's about seeing the future sooner.
It's about hearing the changes, anticipating that next chord and a progression before anyone else in the band. That's the secret sauce of every great improviser, from Louis Armstrong to the modern startup founder. I can't wait to get into it. All right, let's kick off the first tune. Michelle, tell us about Shuangji Dynamics.
Right. So Shuangji Dynamics, or Shuangji Donli in Chinese, they're a brand new company, founded just this year, in 2024, and they made a huge splash, announcing an angel round of nearly 100 million RMB. For our listeners, that's about 14 million US dollars. That is an absolutely massive angel round for a company that's barely a few months old.
That's not seed money. That's rocket fuel. That kind of capital on day one tells you the investors aren't just betting on an idea. They're betting on the musician, not the song. So who is this musician? Tell me more about the founder, OD.
This is the core of the story. OD wasn't just some mid-level manager at DJI. He was the head of the Inspire product line. The article makes a point to say this was DJI's first core product line that was developed entirely from the ground up, in-house. It's known as their most technically comprehensive and complex product, a standard bearer for over a decade. He was responsible for the entire process, from initial research to final launch.
So he wasn't just playing first trumpet. He was writing the arrangements, conducting the orchestra, and probably sweeping the stage after the show. That's the kind of full-stack experience that VCs dream about. He didn't just learn one part of the composition. He understands how every instrument, every section has to work together to create the final piece. That's what we call the DJI DNA. It's a deep, almost instinctual understanding of systems engineering.
And that's exactly his thesis for Schwanji Dynamics. He says that many competitors in the robotics space are essentially just assemblers. They buy off-the-shelf motors, joints, and sensors and piece them together. The demo might look fine, but in a real-world industrial environment, say on a wet, uneven surface in a power substation, it falls apart. He compares it to the early days at DJI, where they went through a long and painful process of iteration to get it right. He's bringing that battle-tested experience to a new field.
This is so crucial. It's the difference between a kid who learned a few flashy licks on YouTube and a classically trained musician who has spent 10,000 hours practicing scales and theory. The flashy kid might sound impressive for 30 seconds, but the trained musician can compose a symphony. Udi is arguing that building a robust, reliable robot is a symphony. You can't just assemble the parts. You have to have a deep, fundamental understanding of how each component affects the whole.
And that philosophy is evident in their technology. Shangji is building everything full stack, from the robot's body to its core components. The most significant piece of this is their proprietary axial flux motor.
Okay, you're gonna have to break that down for me. I know what a motor is, but what makes an axial flux motor special?
I'm glad you asked. So most traditional electric motors are radial flux motors. Think of them as a can with magnets spinning around inside. In an axial flux motor, the design is flat, more like a pancake or a disc. The magnetic flux travels axially along the axis of rotation. The upshot of this is that for the same output, an axial flux motor can be much smaller, flatter, and lighter, but, and this is the key, it can produce significantly more torque, especially at low speeds.
So it's like a new kind of instrument. It's like someone inventing the electric guitar in an age of acoustic instruments. It opens up a whole new range of sounds, a new level of power and expression that just wasn't possible before. For a robot's joints, you don't need high speed. You need powerful, precise, instant torque to hold a position or lift a heavy load.
Exactly. And the numbers they're claiming are staggering. They say their motor has a peak torque of 596 newton meters and a torque density of 240 newton meters per kilogram. For context, that is an incredible amount of twisting force from a very lightweight component. It allows their four-legged robots to have what they call high explosive torque output.
I love that phrase. It's the attack of a note in musical terms, the explosive start of a brass fanfare. It means the robot can react instantly, stabilize itself on treacherous terrain, or carry a heavy payload without buckling.
And they are absolutely focused on payloads. They're working with Southern Power Grid, one of China's largest utility companies, to co-develop a wheeled and legged robot called the Feiyun Titan. This thing is a beast. It's designed for inspecting power lines and substations, often in very remote and difficult to access locations. It has a working payload of 80 kilograms, that's 176 pounds, and an extreme standing load of 200 kilograms. It can climb a single vertical step of up to 1 meter, and its continuous operating time is over 8 hours. These are all specs that they claim are industry-leading.
Okay, now this is getting interesting. This isn't a Boston Dynamics YouTube video designed to go viral. This is a workhorse designed for a specific high-value customer. They didn't just build a cool robot and then go looking for a problem to solve. They went to the customer, Southern Power Grid, and said, "What's the most difficult, discordant part of your daily operations?" And they built an instrument specifically to solve that problem. That is a masterful go-to-market strategy. It's finding your rhythm section first.
It de-risks the whole venture, doesn't it? They have a clear use case, a paying development partner, and a path to mass production, which they say is starting this December. The market for quadruped robots is just starting to take off. The article cites a figure of over 1 billion RMB, about $140 million, in 2024, but with a potential future market in the tens of billions of dollars. The applications are everywhere. Public safety, emergency rescue, logistics, security patrols, and of course, industrial inspection.
But the key, as the founder says, is that market penetration is still very low because the products that exist often aren't good enough. They failed in the field. They can't carry the necessary equipment. The battery life is a joke. Xuanji is betting that their DGI DNA, this obsession with systems integration, reliability, and in-house core tech like their motor, is the key to unlocking this massive market.
It's a compelling argument, but what are the risks here, George? This is still a capital-intensive business. They're competing with established players and a flood of other startups.
The risks are immense. Firstly, hardware is hard. It's a game of atoms, not bits. Supply chains can break, manufacturing tolerances can be off, and a single faulty component can bring the whole system down. Secondly, while the DJI pedigree is a massive advantage, it also sets an incredibly high bar for expectations. Anything less than perfection will be seen as a failure. And thirdly, their ambition. The article mentions they're already working on a consumer-grade robot for next year.
That seems incredibly fast. To go from a high-end industrial B2B product to a B2C product in less than 2 years is a huge leap.
It's like a jazz fusion band that plays incredibly complex 17-minute epics suddenly deciding they're going to write a 3-minute pop hit. It's a completely different skill set. The design principles, call structures, marketing, and user interface for a consumer product are a world away from the Feiyun Titan. That transition is where many hardware companies stumble. But if anyone has the chops to do it, a team with DJI's consumer electronics experience is probably the one. It's a high-risk, high-reward improvisation. It'll be fascinating to see what melody they come up with for the consumer market.
Absolutely. So to sum up Xuanji Dynamics, a founder with an impeccable pedigree, a differentiated core technology and their axial flux motor, a smart go-to-market with a key industrial partner, and a massive war chest from their angel round. The risks are an execution, capital burn, and a potentially distracting pivot to the consumer market. But overall, this is one of the most promising hardware startups we've seen this year.
A truly stellar opening number. It has melody, harmony, and a powerful rhythm. Okay, let's shift gears from the nuts and bolts of robotics to the high-gloss world of million-dollar homes. Tell us how AI is rewriting the real estate playbook.
Now, I have to admit, Michelle, when I think of luxury real estate, I think of glossy magazines, celebrity agents, and big personalities. I don't typically think of algorithms and augmented reality. It feels like an industry that has been deliberately insulated from the kind of disruption we see everywhere else.
That's the traditional view, and for a long time it was true. It was a business built entirely on relationships and who you know. But this Entrepreneur article makes a compelling case that in the fastest growing markets, that model is breaking down. The key insight is that in premium markets, advantage doesn't come from scale or volume. It doesn't matter how many agents you have or how many listings you blast out. The advantage comes from two things: experiential clarity and early insight.
Let's break those down. Experiential clarity sounds like jargon, but I think I get the spirit of it. It's about removing uncertainty for the buyer, right?
Precisely. Think about a high net worth buyer in Hong Kong looking to purchase a home in Paradise Valley, Arizona, a real example from the article. They can't just hop on a plane every weekend to tour properties. The article cites a Coldwell Banker survey that found 77% of luxury home buyers want virtual experiences before they even consider visiting a property in person. We're not talking about a grainy video walkthrough. We're talking about high-fidelity, immersive digital twins of the property, AR and VR experiences where you can understand the flow of the space, see the way the light changes throughout the day, even get a feel for the neighborhood.
It's the difference between listening to a low-quality MP3 of a song and being in the front row at a live concert. One gives you the basic information. The other gives you the feeling. It gives you the soul of the performance. For a decision as emotional and significant as buying a home, that experiential clarity, as you call it, is everything. It compresses the decision-making cycle because it builds trust and emotional connection so much faster.
Exactly. But the second part, early insight, is where the AI really comes into play, and I think it's even more powerful. The article highlights a real estate firm called America One, which has crossed $1 billion in sales. Their secret weapon is an in-house AI engine they call the Equity Propensity Model.
Okay, that sounds like a serious piece of kit. What does it do?
It's a predictive model. It analyzes vast amounts of data, public records, ownership patterns, equity positions, market trends, even behavioral signals, to identify homes that are likely to be listed for sale within the next 12 to 24 months. So before the for sale sign ever goes up, before it hits the MLS or Zillow, their agents are already aware that this specific property might become available.
My God, that's it. That's the whole ball game. That is the Coltrane Giant Steps insight I was talking about. It's the ability to hear the next chord in the progression before the rest of the band even knows the key is changing. In a market where the best properties are often sold off-market, having a one-year head start is not just an advantage, it's an unbeatable superpower. It completely changes the nature of the competition. You're not fighting with 10 other agents over a public listing. You're having a quiet conversation with a homeowner 6 months before they've even decided to sell.
The article frames this as the most important lesson for any entrepreneur using AI. It says, AI creates the most leverage when it helps you see opportunities sooner, not when it merely increases efficiency. So many companies think of AI as a tool for automation, writing emails faster, scheduling meetings, optimizing ad spend, and that's fine. But the real 10x value comes from prediction. It's about using AI to see around the corner.
I love that phrasing. Use AI to see sooner, not shout louder. It should be carved in stone above the door of every startup. It's the essence of strategy. It's the quiet confidence of a master musician like Bill Evans, who could play with such subtlety and nuance that he drew the entire room in. He didn't need to be the loudest player on stage. He was the most insightful. He played the notes that weren't there. This predictive AI is doing the same thing. It's finding the listings that aren't there yet.
And this shift from shouting to seeing also changes the nature of marketing and storytelling. The article points out that in high-trust markets, persuasion and hype are losing their effectiveness. Buyers aren't responding to a louder narrative. They're responding to a more precise one. It's a shift from persuasion to alignment.
Explain that distinction. It sounds important.
Persuasion is about convincing someone to buy your product. Alignment is about helping a customer understand how your product fits into their life, their identity, their long-term goals. For a luxury home buyer, the agent's job isn't to sell them a house. It's to help them find the property that aligns with the life they want to live. It's a more consultative, data-informed, and empathetic approach. The AI provides the what and when, which house, when it might sell, but the human agent's job is to provide the why. Why this home is a perfect fit for you.
The technology provides the sheet music, but the human provides the soul, the interpretation. The AI can analyze the harmony, but the agent has to deliver the melody in a way that resonates with the listener's heart. It's a beautiful synthesis of machine intelligence and human emotional intelligence.
So what are the broader lessons here for founders, even those outside of real estate? The article lists a few key takeaways. 1. Design for decision-making, not just discovery. Use immersive tools to help customers feel the outcome sooner. 2. Use AI to see sooner, not shout louder. Focus on predictive insights. 3. Build narratives that align, not just persuade.
And a final one we haven't touched on? Pair local credibility with scalable distribution. The most successful firms, like America One, have deep, granular knowledge of a specific market like Paradise Valley, but they use technology and partnerships to reach a global audience of buyers.
Depth first, then reach. You have to master your instrument in your hometown before you can sell out Carnegie Hall. It's about building an authentic, credible reputation in one place and then leveraging that trust to expand. You can't do it the other way around.
But this isn't without its own set of risks, right? When you start using predictive AI on people's homes and lives, it can get tricky.
Oh, absolutely. The first risk is the creepiness factor. If an agent contacts you out of the blue and seems to know you might be thinking about selling your house, that can feel intrusive. There's a fine line between insightful service and digital stalking. Managing that communication is a real art.
There are also data privacy concerns. Where is this behavioral signal data coming from? Is it being used ethically? A single misstep here could destroy a brand's reputation, especially in a market built on discretion and trust.
And finally, there's the risk of over-reliance on the algorithm. What if the equity propensity model is wrong? What if it's biased? A great real estate agent has a gut feeling, an intuition built on years of experience. The best approach is to treat the AI as a powerful suggestion engine, not as gospel. It's a tool to augment human judgment, not replace it. The moment you let the machine make all the decisions, you lose the art. You lose the improvisation.
It really is a balancing act. The article concludes by saying that this isn't just a real estate lesson. It's a leadership lesson. The founders who will win the next decade are the ones who treat these technologies, AI, AR, predictive data, as core strategic infrastructure, not just as flashy marketing gimmicks.
That's the perfect final note. It's about fundamentally weaving this new technology into the very rhythm of your business. It's not a one-time solo. It's a new way of composing music. Whether you're building four-legged robots or selling four-bedroom mansions, the ability to see around the corner, to anticipate the next change, and to play the right note at the right time is what separates the legends from the one-hit wonders.
A fantastic summary, George. We've covered a lot of ground in this first segment, from the factory floor to the luxury foyer.
Two incredible performances from two very different bands. And we are back on Startup Jazz, the podcast where we break down the rhythm and blues of the business world. Before the break, we were looking at companies navigating incredible complexity, from the deep engineering of industrial robotics to the predictive power of AI in luxury real estate. But now, Michelle, I want to bring the tempo down a bit. Let's get into the rhythm section. Let's talk about the bass and drums of a startup. The stuff that isn't flashy isn't the trumpet solo, but if it's not locked in, the whole performance falls apart.
Ah, the unglamorous but absolutely essential foundation. You're talking about the operational nitty-gritty, the numbers, the costs. It's the part a lot of founders, especially product-focused or creative founders, tend to ignore until it's a five-alarm fire.
Exactly. They're so focused on composing the melody that they forget to check if the band is in tune. And that brings us to our first piece for this set. It's not a company, but an idea from an entrepreneur article that I think every single one of our listeners needs to hear. The title is Seven Hidden Costs That Are Eating Up Your Small Business. It's all about the slow bleed, the quiet, boring expenses that, as the author puts it, slowly choke profitability.
This is so critical. The article states that 35% of small businesses aren't profitable, and it's rarely one catastrophic mistake. It's death by a thousand paper cuts, or in 2024 terms, death by a thousand unnoticed subscription charges.
Precisely. So let's break down this composition. The first hidden cost the article points out is maybe the most important, the cost of not knowing your numbers. This is the absolute bedrock. It's like a musician who doesn't know their scales. How can you improvise? How can you make decisions if you don't know the fundamental structure of the music you're playing?
It's so true. The article says not knowing your numbers leads to two common disastrous outcomes, overspending and undercharging. You're flying blind. You think you have cash in the bank, but you're not tracking your burn rate, your customer acquisition cost, CAC, your lifetime value. You're making decisions based on gut feelings, which can work for a while, but it's not a scalable strategy. The recommendation here is simple but powerful. Get your bookkeeping caught up and look at your profit and loss statement at least once a month.
It's your sheet music. You have to read the chart before you can start playing. If you don't, you might think you're in the key of C major when the band has modulated to F sharp minor and suddenly you're hitting all the wrong notes. Firing someone, launching a new product, doubling down on a marketing channel, doing any of that without the data is just guessing.
And guessing is expensive. Okay, hidden cost number two, the cost of doing everything yourself. This one hits home for every founder I've ever met. They think hiring is a luxury, but the article frames it as the very thing that creates capacity for growth.
This is the classic trap of a brilliant soloist who thinks they need to be a one-man band. They're trying to play the piano melody with their right hand, the bass line with their left, stomp out a drum beat with their foot, and maybe play a harmonica on a neck rack.
You can do it, sure, but the sound is thin. Every hour a founder spends on a $10 an hour task that someone else could do is an hour they're not spending on the $1,000 an hour task of steering a ship.
The math is undeniable. If your time is worth, say, $200 an hour when you're doing sales or strategy, and you spend 3 hours a week formatting a newsletter or scheduling social media posts, tasks you could outsource for $25 an hour, you're not saving money. You're actively losing $525 a week in potential value. That's over $27,000 a year you're leaving on the table because you refuse to delegate.
It's a very expensive choice indeed. All right, number three on the list flows right from that. The cost of poor systems. The article says, if your processes live inside your head, your business is already paying for it. I love that line.
It's a huge liability. It means you can't scale, you can't onboard new people effectively, and you can't take a vacation without the whole operation grinding to a halt. Inconsistent workflows lead to mistakes, missed deadlines, and unhappy customers. It creates what I call process debt, which is just as dangerous as technical debt or financial debt. You have to pay it back eventually, and the interest is brutal.
It's the difference between a tightly arranged Duke Ellington piece, where every musician knows their part and when to come in, and a chaotic free jazz jam session where everyone is just making noise. Now, free jazz has its place. It can be brilliant, but you can't build a sustainable, repeatable business model on it. You need some structure, some kind of lead sheet that the whole band can follow. Otherwise, your team is constantly asking you for the next chord change.
And that costs you time, and it costs them time. The suggestion is to create just one or two new systems per month. Document one process. Create one template. It's an incremental approach, but it pays huge dividends.
I like that. Don't try to write the whole symphony at once. Just compose one bar at a time. Okay, what's next on this list of margin killers?
Number four, the cost of outdated or poorly utilized tools. Ah, the dreaded SaaS subscription creep. This is the modern day equivalent of a leaky faucet. A little drip here, a little drip there, and by the end of the year, you flooded the basement.
It's so true. You sign up for a 14-day free trial of some project management tool, you put in the company credit card, and then 2 years later, you realize you're still paying $49 a month for a piece of software three people on your team logged into once.
Exactly. The article breaks it into three categories of tech waste. One, paying for tools you just don't use. Two, using the wrong tools for the job, which is inefficient. And three, which I see all the time, using the right tools, but only using 10% of their capability because no one ever got properly trained on them. So you're paying for a full grand piano, but only ever playing chopsticks on it.
That's a great way to put it. You bought a Steinway when all you needed was a practice keyboard. The advice is to do a subscription audit. Pull every recurring charge from the last 6 months and ask the hard questions. Are we using this? Is there overlap? Can we consolidate? Be ruthless.
It's financial hygiene. Moving on to number five, a personal favorite of mine, the cost of no marketing analytics. This is where businesses just set money on fire. They're boosting posts on Instagram or running Google ads without tracking ROI, CAC, or LTV. It's pure guesswork.
It's like a saxophonist taking a long, indulgent solo with their eyes closed, completely ignoring what the rest of the band is doing. They might be playing something technically amazing, but if it doesn't connect with the harmony the band is laying down, if it doesn't resonate with the market, it's just noise. Marketing analytics is your way of listening to the band. It's the call and response with your audience. You play a line, and you see how they react. Do they tap their feet? Do they start dancing? Or do they head for the exits?
And if you're not measuring that reaction, you have no idea what's working. You could be spending 80% of your budget on a channel that brings in 5% of your customers. The article makes a great point. If you don't have this skill in-house, hiring a marketing analyst or a good fractional CMO will easily pay for itself by stopping the bleeding.
Absolutely. Knowledge is power. And in this case, it's also profit. Okay, we've got two left. What's number six?
Number six is a big one. The cost of underpricing. So many founders, especially in the early days, lack the confidence to charge what they're worth. They don't properly account for all their input costs, their labor, their overhead, and a healthy margin.
They're afraid to ask for the right fee for the gig. They think, if I charge too much, the club owner won't book me. But if you don't charge enough to cover your travel, your instrument maintenance, your time, and still make a profit, you're not running a business. You're funding the hobby, and you'll burn out.
And in an inflationary environment, this is even more dangerous. Your costs for everything, software, shipping, materials, labor, are going up. If your prices stay flat, your margins are getting squeezed from both ends until they disappear. You have to bake in all your costs, and you have to have the courage to adjust your pricing as your costs change. A small miscalculation here, especially in low-margin businesses, can be fatal.
A painful but necessary truth. And that brings us to the grand finale, the seventh hidden cost.
The cost of slow or inefficient sales operations. This is about fumbling the ball at the one-yard line. You've done the hard work of marketing, you've generated a lead, they're interested, and then the proposal takes a week to get out, or they have a question and no one follows up, or they make a purchase and the onboarding process is confusing and manual. You're losing revenue not because of a lack of demand, but because of friction in your own process.
The intro was great, the verse was cooking, and then you flub the solo. You lose the audience. It's a systems problem, just like we talked about earlier, but specifically applied to your revenue engine. It's a leaky bucket. You're spending all this money on marketing to fill the bucket, but the holes in your sales process mean the water is just pouring out the bottom.
It's so common. The good news, as the article points out, is that it's very fixable. It's about mapping out your customer journey, identifying the friction points, and using a combination of process improvements and technology, like a good CRM, to smooth them out. Commit to fixing one part of your sales funnel at a time.
So to recap this set, know your numbers, delegate, build systems, audit your tools, track your marketing, price correctly, and tighten up your sales process. It's not the sexy stuff, Michelle. It's the hours in the practice room, running scales and rehearsing with the band. But it's the work that separates the weekend warriors from the pros who play the main stage at Newport.
Well said. And I think that provides a perfect, and I mean perfect, transition to our next company. We've been talking about the theory of financial discipline and avoiding hidden costs. And now we get to look at a company that seems to be a masterclass in exactly that. A Shenzhen-based e-bike company called Heybike.
Ah, now this is a fascinating story. I was reading the 36KR piece on them, and a few numbers just jumped off the page. In just 4 years, they've hit over $100 million in annual revenue, selling over 200,000 e-bikes a year, primarily in the competitive North American market.
Impressive numbers for sure. But here's the kicker, the part that really made me sit up and take notice. They have been profitable since their first year of operation, and they have taken zero external funding. No VC money, no private equity, nothing. They are completely bootstrapped.
That, my friends, is playing a different kind of music altogether. In a world where the dominant sound is the loud, frantic, bit-scaling bebop of venture capital, grow at all costs, burn cash to capture market share, Heybike is playing cool jazz. It's disciplined. It's controlled. It reminds me of the modern jazz quartet. They didn't need a massive big band to make a powerful statement. They did it with four instruments, every note precise, no wasted energy. That's Heybike.
That's a fantastic analogy. Let's get into their background. The founders weren't new to this space. They had been in the micromobility world since 2014, one focusing on electric scooters for the Chinese domestic market, the other on overseas scooter operations. So they had deep experience in the supply chain, in manufacturing, and in the R&D of personal electric vehicles.
They were session musicians who had played on a lot of other people's records. The article mentions that they started by doing contract manufacturing, OEM work, for other Western brands. They were honing their craft, building their chops, and most importantly, building their own capital reserves behind the scenes.
Exactly. They weren't just two people with an idea and a pitch deck. They had a decade of industry experience and a functioning, profitable manufacturing business before they even launched their own brand. So in 2021, right at the peak of the e-bike investment frenzy, they decided to step out from the shadows and become the headliners. They launched the Heybike brand.
And talk about timing. 2021 was when the e-bike market was white hot. You had American brands like Rad Power Bikes and Aventon raising hundreds of millions. European brands like Van Moof, which we've discussed on the show before, were also raising massive rounds from top-tier VCs like Sequoia. It was a gold rush.
It was. And that's what makes Heybike's strategy so counterintuitive and brilliant.
everyone else was raising nine-figure rounds to pour into marketing and rapid expansion. The founders of Heybike looked at all that and said, "No, thank you. We'll use our own money." The CEO, Feng Humin, is quoted as saying, "We hope to use our own funds to control our rhythm and invest more resources in R&D and quality control."
Control our rhythm. See? The man gets it. He understood that taking on that much VC money is like having a hyper-caffeinated drummer who is just playing blast beats at 300 beats per minute. You have no choice but to try and keep up, whether it makes musical sense or not. Heybike wanted to set their own tempo.
And they did it by being incredibly strategic about where they entered the market. They analyzed the North American market, specifically on Amazon, and they saw two dominant categories. You had the low-end, sub-$700 e-bikes with questionable quality, and then you had the high-end, $1,500 to $2,000 plus fat tire enthusiast bikes. They identified what the article calls a demand fault line, or gap, right in the middle.
They found the pocket. That's what a great bass player does. They don't just play the root note on the one. They find that perfect syncopated note in between the beats that makes the whole groove feel right. Heybike saw that space for a high-quality, reliable, practical commuter and leisure e-bike in the, say, $900 to $1,400 range. A bike that wasn't a cheap toy, but also wasn't a high-performance machine for hardcore off-roaders.
That was their entry point. They used their manufacturing expertise to build a quality product at a competitive price point for that mid-market, and they used Amazon as their primary channel to quickly get volume and build brand awareness without needing a massive marketing budget or a physical retail footprint. It was a classic wedge strategy.
And it worked. The article calls their approach a quite manjiga, or a fast-slow combination. I love this. It's a fundamental concept in music, dynamics, and tempo. They moved fast to launch on Amazon and capture that initial market share. But then they moved slow and deliberately on other things. They didn't chase a huge number of SKUs. They didn't rush into new markets like Southeast Asia or Latin America. While their VC-funded competitors were frantically expanding, Heybike spent 2 years methodically researching user needs in their core North American market to develop specific regional models.
That discipline is astounding. Think about the pressure they must have felt. Their competitors are announcing massive funding rounds. They're on the cover of magazines. They're hiring hundreds of people. And Heybike is just quietly executing its plan, focusing on product and profitability. It's the tortoise and the hare. And we all know what happened to some of those hares. Van Moof's bankruptcy is a cautionary tale for the whole industry.
A cautionary tale about a band that spent all its money on pyrotechnics and a fancy tour bus, but forgot to write good songs. So, Michelle, let's break down the opportunities and risks here. What's the upside for Heybike?
The biggest opportunity is their resilience. Because they're not beholden to investors, they are masters of their own destiny. They can make long-term decisions that are right for the business, not just decisions that will juice the numbers for the next board meeting to set up a Series C. Their focus on R&D and quality, funded by their own profits, creates a sustainable competitive advantage. Their Shenzhen base gives them an incredible supply chain advantage that Western companies struggle to match. They've proven the model, and now they can scale it deliberately.
They own their own masters, as they say in the music business. But what are the risks? What's the B-side to this record?
Well, the obvious risk is the flip side of their strength. Can they compete long-term without a massive war chest? The e-bike market isn't getting any less competitive. You have huge established players like Giant and Trek moving more aggressively into the space. You still have well-funded D2C brands. Can Heybike's organic, profit-driven marketing compete with a rival who can afford to spend $50 million on a brand campaign?
That's the big question. Can a tight jazz trio really fill a stadium the way a rock band with a wall of amps can? Maybe not, but they can own the jazz clubs forever. Maybe their goal isn't world domination, but to be the most respected and profitable player in their chosen niche.
That's a fair point. Another risk is their channel dependence. They built their success on Amazon, which is great for volume, but also means you're playing in Amazon's sandbox. Amazon controls the customer relationship, they can change their algorithms, they can raise their fees. Diversifying into their own direct-to-consumer channel and potentially physical retail will be a critical next step, but it's also expensive and complex.
A very real challenge. It's like a band that gets famous from one hit song on the radio.
How do you translate that into a sustainable touring career and a dedicated fan base that will buy your albums directly?
Exactly. And finally, there's the market risk. The e-bike boom was fueled by the pandemic. As things normalize, will that growth rate continue, or will the market flatten out or even contract? Heybike's lean, profitable model makes them better equipped to handle a downturn than a cash brand unicorn, but a significant market slowdown would hurt everyone.
No doubt. But I have to say, Michelle, I find this story incredibly refreshing. It's a different tune in a startup world that can often feel like a monotonous four-on-the-floor dance track. Heybike is a reminder that you can build a significant, profitable, nine-figure business by focusing on the fundamentals, product, customers, and a sustainable financial rhythm. You don't always need the flashy VC solo to make beautiful music.
I couldn't agree more. It's a testament to discipline, patience, and deep industry expertise, a model that many more aspiring entrepreneurs should be studying.
Indeed, a powerful performance from a band that chose to write its own charts. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be diving into the world of venture capital and some truly mind-boggling deals. You're listening to Startup Jazz.
And we are back on Startup Jazz, where we're digging into the biggest stories shaping the venture landscape. Before the break, we were talking about the importance of fundamentals, using the bootstrap success of e-bike company Heybike as a masterclass in financial discipline. But George, our first deep dive today feels like the complete opposite of that. We're talking about the new class of unicorns, the companies that are going from a back-of-the-napkin idea to a billion-dollar valuation in what feels like the blink of an eye.
It's astonishing, Michelle. The tempo has just gone through the roof. We're not talking about a steady swing rhythm anymore. This is pure, frantic, high-energy bebop. It's like watching a young Charlie Parker take the stage. The notes are flying so fast and furious, you can barely keep up. But you know you're witnessing something revolutionary. And right now, the name of that tune is artificial intelligence.
That's the perfect way to put it. A recent Crunchbase report laid it out in stark terms. In 2025, 46 companies founded in just the last 3 years have achieved unicorn status. And get this, a whopping 36 of them are in AI. Collectively, these newborns pulled in nearly $39 billion in new investment this year alone. It's a concentration of capital unlike anything we've seen.
$39 billion. Let that sink in. That's more than the entire venture capital industry used to deploy in a year not too long ago. And it's going to companies that, in many cases, don't have a commercial product yet. It's a pure bet on the band leader and the sheet music.
And the band leader everyone is watching, of course, is Elon Musk with XAI. The article points out that he first publicly announced the company in July of 2023. We're recording this at the end of 2025, so that's less than 2.5 years ago. In that time, they've raised more than $12 billion in venture funding, plus billions more in other financing. It's just staggering.
It is. With Musk, you're always dealing with a different kind of composition. He's like the Duke Ellington of the tech world. Ellington had this incredible gravity. He could attract the absolute best musicians to his orchestra simply because he was Duke. They wanted to be part of his sound, part of his vision. Musk has that same pull. He announces he's starting an AI company to, and I quote, understand the true nature of the universe, and the best talent and the biggest checks in the world just line up at his door.
That's a great comparison. And it's a huge competitive advantage. He can assemble a team of all-stars from DeepMind, OpenAI, Google, Microsoft almost overnight. But what are they actually building? The product, Grok, is integrated into X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. It's positioned as a more rebellious, less woke alternative to ChatGPT. But is that a $12 billion idea? The valuation seems to be based less on the current product and more on the promise of what this all-star band could create down the line.
And that's the inherent risk, isn't it? Ellington's orchestra worked because he was a master composer and arranger who knew how to make all those incredible soloists sound good together.
With XAI, the bet is that Musk can do the same. The risk is that you have a collection of brilliant minds all pulling in slightly different directions, fueled by an astronomical burn rate. The capital gives them an incredible runway, but it also creates immense pressure to deliver something that justifies not just the investment, but the mythos surrounding the founder.
And they're not the only ones playing this high-stakes game. Let's talk about Mistral AI, the Paris-based contender. They were founded in April 2023, even younger than XAI. In that incredibly short time, they've raised over $3 billion and are valued at $14 billion. Their founders are also alumni of the big tech AI labs, specifically Google's DeepMind and Meta.
What I find fascinating about Mistral is their different approach to the music. While OpenAI and, to a large extent, Anthropic are playing a very tightly controlled proprietary composition, Mistral has leaned into an open source model. They're putting their scores out there for everyone to see and play with.
Exactly. They offer both open weight models that developers can freely use and modify, and more powerful commercial models they sell through an API. It's a hybrid strategy. The idea is that by empowering the open source community, they build a massive developer following and a vibrant ecosystem around their technology, which in turn drives adoption of their paid products. It's a classic open core playbook, but applied to the most advanced technology on the planet.
It's a very jazz-like philosophy. It reminds me of the tradition of trading fours, where musicians on the bandstand would trade four-bar solos, openly sharing and building on each other's melodic ideas. It's a collaborative, improvisational process. That open exchange is what pushed the art form forward. Mistral is betting that this same dynamic will accelerate AI innovation. They're essentially hosting a global jam session.
But that jam session comes with risks. By making their models open, they have less control over how they're used. There are concerns about misuse for things like generating misinformation or malicious code. Plus, they're competing against giants like Meta, which is also a huge proponent of open source AI and has far deeper pockets. So while it's a compelling differentiator, it's not a guaranteed path to victory.
No, it's not. And that brings us to the other theme from this article, the incredible talent drain from the top labs, particularly OpenAI. It feels like every few months, a key figure leaves to start their own thing and immediately raises $1 billion.
It's the OpenAI mafia in full effect. The article highlights two perfect examples. First, Safe Superintelligence, or SSI, founded by OpenAI's co-founder and former chief scientist, the legendary Ilya Sutskever. He started the company just 18 months ago, and they've already raised at least $3 billion. Their mission is laser-focused: build a safe, powerful AI system and nothing else. No distractions from products or business models, just pure R&D.
Only in this market can you raise $3 billion by promising not to have a business model. It's incredible.
And then there's Thinking Machines Lab, co-founded by Mira Murati, who was OpenAI CTO. They launched just 10 months ago and have already pocketed $2 billion. The details are still a bit vague, but the pedigree of the founders is so strong that investors are lining up.
This is the jazz supergroup phenomenon. It's like when Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, and Tony Williams got back together with Freddie Hubbard to form the VSOP Quintet. They were all legends from Miles Davis's second great quintet. The moment they announced a tour, every ticket was sold out before they'd played a single note together. The expectation was immense because of their history. SSI and Thinking Machines are the VSOP quintets of AI.
That's the perfect analogy, and investors are paying a hefty premium for those front row tickets. The logic, as the article puts it, is to pick early, invest generously. Venture capitalists have identified what they believe is the single most important technological shift of our generation, foundational AI models, and they've identified the handful of people on Earth who have actually built these things at scale. So they're not waiting. They're bypassing the seed and Series A rounds and going straight to a 9 or 10 figure check.
They're trying to sign the next John Coltrane right after he's left the Miles Davis Quintet. They heard his solo on So What, and they know he's destined for greatness. They're willing to give him an unprecedented recording budget, complete artistic freedom, and a multi-album deal, all in the hope that he'll go on to produce his A Love Supreme. The opportunity is to back a company that could become a trillion-dollar entity. The risk is that you pour billions into an experimental project that, while technically brilliant, never finds a commercial audience. you get a lot of expensive atonal screeching instead of a masterpiece.
And the numbers show just how concentrated this strategy has become. The article has a chart showing that in 2025, over $115 billion has gone into mega rounds, rounds of $100 million or more, for companies less than 3 years old. That's more than the previous peak in the frothy market of 2021, but this time it's concentrated in far fewer, mostly AI deals.
That's the part that gives me pause. The entire industry is placing its chips on the same few numbers on the roulette wheel. It creates this hyper-competitive, hyper-expensive environment where startups are raising money not just for R&D and compute, but as a strategic weapon to poach talent from each other. The salaries and equity packages being offered are astronomical. The burn rates must be terrifying.
Absolutely. And what happens when the music stops, or at least when the tempo slows down? Right now, the excitement around generative AI is still at a fever pitch, but eventually, these companies have to build sustainable businesses. They have to find customers willing to pay enough to offset the colossal costs of training and running these models. For xAI, Mistral, SSI, and the others, the clock is ticking, even if it's a very, very expensive clock.
It's a high-wire act with no net. The potential upside is a paradigm shift in technology and the creation of immense wealth. The downside is a pile of smoldering servers and some of the most spectacular write-downs in venture capital history. It's a wild, improvisational solo, and we have no idea how it's going to end.
A perfect summary. The speed and scale are breathtaking. But speaking of wild improvisations and head-scratching combinations, our next story is, well, it's in a league of its own. It involves deep tech, big money, and a merger so unexpected it left everyone in the business world speechless.
Don't tell me we're going there. You're talking about the fusion deal, aren't you? Michelle, that's not just a different key signature. That's a different genre of music entirely. It's like a free jazz ensemble suddenly announcing a merger with a classical string quartet. The instruments don't even seem to belong in the same concert hall.
That's one way to put it, but we have to talk about it. The news dropped like a bomb. Trump Media and Technology Group, or TMTG, the company behind the Truth Social platform, announced it's merging with TAE Technologies, a nuclear fusion company.
I've read it a dozen times, and I still can't quite make it make sense. On one hand, you have a social media company that's deeply intertwined with politics, media, and the daily news cycle. Its success is measured in daily active users and engagement metrics. On the other hand, you have a deep tech, R&D-heavy company trying to solve one of the most complex physics problems known to man, commercializing nuclear fusion. What is the synergy? What's the shared vision?
There is none. Let's be clear, this is not a business merger in the traditional sense. It's a financial transaction. But to understand how bizarre it is, we need to understand who TAE Technologies is, because they are a very serious and legitimate player in their field. The Crunchbase article gives us some great background. They were founded way back in 1998, making them one of the oldest venture-backed fusion companies out there.
So they've been at this for a long time. This isn't some flash-in-the-pan startup. This is a long-term, dedicated scientific endeavor.
Exactly. And they are incredibly well-funded by very sophisticated investors. To date, they've raised close to $1.5 billion. Their backers include Google, Chevron Technology Ventures, and New Enterprises Associates, one of the most respected venture firms in the world. This is not a fringe operation. It's a mainstream, blue-chip deep tech company.
And what they're trying to do, I mean, it's the holy grail of energy. For our listeners who might not be familiar, fusion is the process that powers the sun. It's about smashing light atoms together to release massive amounts of energy. If we can harness it on Earth, it promises clean, safe, carbon-free, and virtually limitless power. It would change the world. But it's also notoriously difficult. There's no joke in the physics community that commercial fusion is always 30 years away.
And it's been 30 years away for about 60 years now. But that's starting to change. There's been a huge influx of private capital into the space, betting that recent breakthroughs in computing, material science, and magnets could finally make it a reality. The Crunchbase data shows that fusion startups have raised over $7 billion in the last 5 years alone.
So the sector itself is hot. This isn't a crazy bet in a vacuum.
You have other major players like Commonwealth Fusion Systems, which spun out of MIT and has raised almost $3 billion, and Helion Energy, backed by Sam Altman, which has raised over $1 billion. These companies are making real, tangible progress toward achieving net energy gain. So TAE is part of a legitimate, exciting, and well-funded technological movement.
Right. And that's what makes the merger so confounding. TMTG, which itself went public via a SPAC merger, is a highly volatile stock inextricably linked to the political fortunes of Donald Trump. Its user base is a specific political demographic. TAE, on the other hand, is a 25-year-old scientific project backed by global corporations and institutional VCs, working on a multi-decade timeline. What could they possibly gain from this?
That's the multi-billion-dollar question. From TAE's perspective, this could be a way to access the public markets and a huge pool of capital without going through the scrutiny of a traditional IPO. An IPO for a pre-revenue fusion company would be a tough sell to institutional public market investors. This merger gives them a publicly traded stock and a path to liquidity. But the cost? The cost is tying your scientific reputation to a volatile and polarizing media brand.
The reputational risk seems enormous. Can you imagine their scientists trying to recruit top physicists and telling them, oh, by the way, our parent company is Truth Social, or trying to sign partnerships with governments or utility companies? It introduces a layer of political and brand complexity that a company like this just doesn't need.
And from the TMTG side, what's the narrative for their investors? They bought into a media and tech company, a free speech platform. Now they're being told that their company is also a bet on antineutronic fusion technology using a field-reversed configuration machine. It's just worlds apart. The investment thesis is completely incoherent.
The announcement called it a stock transaction valued at over $6 billion, with shareholders of each company owning about half of the combined entity. The market initially reacted positively, with TMTG stock jumping, but it's hard to see a long-term strategy here. It feels like financial engineering, plain and simple.
This entire deal feels like a forced collaboration. You know, in jazz, sometimes the most dissonant, unexpected chord progressions can resolve into something truly beautiful and surprising. A good musician can create tension and then release it in a satisfying way. But most of the time, dissonance is just dissonance. It's just noise. This merger feels like two different bands playing two completely different songs in different keys and different time signatures on the same stage at the same time. The rhythm section is completely lost, and the audience is just confused.
That is the most accurate description I've heard. So let's break down the opportunities and risks. For TAE, the opportunity is capital, a massive infusion of it, through a public listing they might not otherwise get. The risk is everything else: their reputation, their scientific credibility, their ability to recruit, their relationships with institutional partners. It's a huge gamble.
A Faustian bargain, perhaps. And for TMTG, the opportunity is to latch onto something that has the veneer of serious world-changing technology. It allows them to tap into the excitement around deep tech and clean energy. The risk is that their investor base has absolutely no patience for the timeline of fusion energy. This isn't a project that delivers quarterly results. The investment in fusion is a long, slow-burning ballad, not a 3-minute pop hit. How long before their shareholders get tired of waiting for a breakthrough that could still be a decade away?
It's a fascinating, if perplexing, case study. It shows how the weird world of SPACs and public market dealmaking can create combinations that would never happen in the private venture world. No VC would ever fund this merger. But in the public markets, stranger things have happened.
Indeed. It's a reminder that not every startup story is a clean, linear progression. Sometimes the path is messy, unpredictable, and downright weird. This one is definitely at the top of the weird list for 2025. It's a composition I don't think anyone will be looking to replicate soon.
I think you're right about that. It's a true one-of-a-kind. Okay, we've covered the hyperspeed world of AI unicorns and the baffling world of media fusion mergers. When we come back, we'll be shifting gears to talk about the public markets and a classic brand that's getting a modern remix. That and more when Startup Jaws returns.
And we are back for the final set of episode 12 of Startup Jazz.
We've covered the AI gold rush. We've dissected a truly bizarre merger. And now we're bringing it all back home. We've got two very different stories to close out the show, Michelle. One is a look at the entire orchestra, the public markets, and whether they're finally ready to play some new tunes. The other is a deep cut, a classic standard getting a modern remix.
That's a perfect way to put it, George. We're going from the macro to the micro. First, we're looking at a Crunchbase report that's got every late-stage founder and their VCs buzzing, the potential return of the tech IPO. And then we're diving into the acquisition of a brand I think everyone listening has eaten at some point, California Pizza Kitchen. Two very different tales of capital, growth, and reinvention.
Absolutely. So let's kick things off with that big picture view, the IPO market. For the past few years, it's been quiet. It's been like the whole band took a long, extended rest, a tacit, if you will. The stage was dark, the audience was waiting, but the musicians were just backstage, tuning their instruments, waiting for the right moment.
And according to this Crunchbase piece, it seems like the house lights started to flicker back on in 2025. The article, titled Crunchbase Predicts IPOs Picked Up in 2025 and the Outlook for 2026 is Even More Optimistic, lays out a pretty compelling case that the freeze is thawing.
It really does. The numbers alone tell a story. In 2025, at least 23 U.S.-based companies went public with valuations over $1 billion. Compare that to just 9 in all of 2024. That's a significant jump in the tempo.
It's more than double the activity, and the total value of those listings is even more impressive. We're talking $125 billion in total valuation at the IPO price. That's more than double the value from the previous year. So not only are more companies going out, but they're bigger, more substantial companies.
Exactly. We're not talking about small combo acts anymore. These are the big bands taking the stage. The article quotes Amin Singh from the law firm Fenwick & West, who worked on some of the year's biggest deals, like the CoreWeave and Figma IPOs. He says that folks were optimistic coming into 2025, and that optimism was largely rewarded.
Well, mostly rewarded. He does mention that a government shutdown late in the year kind of chilled the market and put some things on hold. He expects that to create a bit of a backlog, making the first quarter of 2026 potentially even busier. But the big question is, what's driving this? Why now?
It's the macroeconomic environment, the overall rhythm section of the economy. Singh points to interest rates. If they continue to come down, as many expect, it creates a much more conducive environment for risk-on assets. And IPOs are definitely a risk-on asset. It makes it easier for investors to justify putting capital into a newly public company. The cost of capital comes down, and the whole tune just sounds sweeter.
And it's not just about the macro environment. The profile of the companies themselves has changed. This isn't the 2021 growth at all cost party anymore. Singh says that in this market, the ideal candidate for a 2026 IPO is a profitable company. Profitability is the new baseline. And on top of that, it helps immensely if you're either a pure play AI company or have a very convincing story about how AI is a major tailwind for your business.
That's the new melody everyone wants to hear. It's not enough to have a solid rhythm section of revenue. You need that soaring, memorable AI melody on top. And we saw that with the class of 2025. The article highlights some of the big names: CoreWeave, the AI data center company; Figma, the design platform that everyone knows; Chime, the digital bank; and even the Swedish fintech giant Klarna finally made its debut.
And of those, CoreWeave was the star performer. The article notes that as of mid-December 2025, its stock was up over 60% from its listing price. That is a massive signal to the market. When a high-profile, venture-backed tech company goes out and not only prices well, but also trades up significantly, it gives every other unicorn board of directors a huge dose of confidence.
It's the breakout solo that gets the whole crowd on its feet. It shows what's possible. CoreWeave came out and just wailed on the saxophone. And suddenly, every other musician is thinking, okay, this audience is ready. It's my turn to play. It proves there's an appetite for these stories, especially the AI-centric ones.
Looking at the sector breakdown is also fascinating.
Of those $23 billion-plus listings, the leader was biotech and healthcare with 6 companies. That's not a huge surprise. It's a very different kind of market with its own cycles. But the next biggest was blockchain and crypto with 4 companies. That, to me, is a real sign of a vibe shift.
After the long crypto winter, that section of the orchestra is starting to heat up again.
Exactly. The article mentions stablecoin provider Circle, crypto exchange Bullish, and blockchain lending firm Figure all had successful listings and were trading up from their IPO prices. The only one lagging was Gemini, but for 3 out of 4 to be doing well is a very strong signal for that sector's recovery.
It feels like the market has matured. It's moved past the wild, speculative free jazz of the last crypto boom and is now rewarding companies with real infrastructure, real products, and maybe even, dare I say it, real business models. Circle, with its USDC stablecoin, is essentially a core piece of financial plumbing at this point. That's a different story than a meme coin.
Right. It's a story investors can underwrite. So we have this picture of a recovering market. But what I want to dig into is the tension the article mentions. On one hand, you have this trend of companies staying private for longer. The private markets are so deep now that you can raise billions without ever having to deal with the scrutiny of a quarterly earnings call.
The freedom to improvise without having to play the same hit song every 3 months for Wall Street.
That's the appeal. But on the other hand, Aman Singh makes the critical point. You can't match public market liquidity. At some point, your early investors and your employees need an exit. VCs have to return capital to their LPs. Employees who have been vesting stock options for a decade want to be able to buy a house. That pressure builds and builds, and the IPO is still the most effective release valve.
Is the ultimate crescendo. You can play in the practice room for years, but eventually, you have to perform on the main stage at Carnegie Hall. That's where you get the real validation and, of course, the real payday.
So the pressure is there, the macro environment is improving, but there's still one piece of the puzzle that's a bit wobbly, valuation. Singh notes there's still some uncertainty there. In 2021, you could slap a 50x revenue multiple on a SaaS company and call it a day. Now it's not so simple. Investors are much more discerning. They're looking at profitability, free cash flow, and sustainable growth.
The chords are more complex now. It's not just a simple I-4-5 progression. There are more diminished sevenths and augmented fifths in there. The market is trying to figure out the right harmony for this new era.
I think that's the perfect analogy. And every company that goes out, like a CoreWeave or a Figma, provides another data point. It helps the next company and their bankers figure out where to price the deal. It's a process of rediscovering the market's key signature. Singh is hopeful that as more tech IPOs go out, valuations will stabilize and the environment will become more certain.
And what about the big ones? The article mentions related reading about companies like Anthropic or even SpaceX. Are we going to see these titans finally hit the public stage in 2026?
That's the trillion-dollar question, literally in SpaceX's case. Singh predicts that the back half of 2026 is when we might start seeing some of those bigger listings. It takes a while to get the machinery going for an IPO of that scale. But I think the success of the 2025 class is what makes that possible. A company like Figma, for instance. Remember, their $20 billion acquisition by Adobe was blocked by regulators. For them to turn around and execute a successful IPO is a huge story of resilience. It proves there's a strong, viable path outside of acquisition.
It's a powerful statement. It says you can write your own music. You don't have to just be a session player for a bigger band. You can be the band leader.
And for every founder of a $5 or $10 billion company watching that, it's incredibly encouraging. So my takeaway from this is cautiously optimistic. The IPO window isn't wide open, but it's definitely been propped open. The companies that are disciplined, profitable, and have a compelling, modern narrative, especially around AI, are the ones that are going to be able to climb through it in 2026. But any major macroeconomic shock, another government shutdown, or a spike in inflation could slam it shut again.
The band is playing, but everyone has one eye on the conductor and the other on the exit. It's a fragile but exciting moment, a great way to start our final set. All right, so from the sprawling, complex symphony of the public markets, we're going to shift our focus to a single instrument, a very familiar one. We're talking about a brand that, for many of us, defined fancy pizza in the 90s and 2000s.
I know exactly where you're going with this. We are talking about California Pizza Kitchen, or CPK.
And the news, from an article in Entrepreneur, is that CPK has been sold for just under $300 million to an investor group led by a firm called Consortium Brand Partners.
CPK, the home of the original barbecue chicken pizza. It's a true classic standard from the Great American Restaurant Songbook. Founded back in 1985 in Beverly Hills, of all places, by two former federal prosecutors. Talk about a career pivot. They looked at the pizza landscape, which was all pepperoni and mushrooms, and decided to improvise.
They really did. They put things on pizza that people had never thought of. Thai chicken, California Club with avocado, that famous barbecue chicken. It was innovative, and it totally captured the California zeitgeist of the moment. They essentially created the premium casual pizza category.
They did, and they had a great run. They expanded across the country, became a staple in every upscale mall, and really built a powerful brand. But, like many legacy restaurant chains, the last decade has been more challenging. The music changed.
That's putting it mildly. The rise of fast casual competitors, the dominance of delivery apps, and then, of course, the pandemic, which was an existential crisis for any business built on in-person dining. The article notes that CPK actually filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy back in 2020.
That was the break in the music, a sudden, dramatic stop. It looked like the song might be over for them, but they managed to restructure and come out of it. And now this acquisition marks a new chapter. The new owners are talking about a new era of growth.
This is a classic private equity style playbook, even if Consortium Brand Partners is more of an investment group. They're buying a legacy brand with strong name recognition, but some operational baggage, and they think they can unlock new value. The price tag, just under $300 million, tells you something. It's not a distressed asset price, but it's not the valuation of a high-growth tech company either. It's the price for a solid, established brand that needs a tune-up.
So the new band leader is stepping up to the podium. What's that new arrangement going to sound like?
The strategy seems to have three main prongs, according to the article. First, franchise expansion. This is straight out of the PE handbook. Shifting from a corporate-owned model to a franchise model reduces your capital expenditures and allows for faster, less risky growth. You're essentially licensing out the brand in the playbook and taking a cut.
So you're not building all the new concert halls yourself. You're letting local promoters do it and just showing up to play the gig.
Exactly. The second prong is new products. This is a bit vague, but it likely means menu innovation to keep up with changing tastes and maybe new offerings in their other channels. Which brings us to the third, and in my opinion, most important prong, an enhanced retail presence.
Ah, the frozen pizza aisle, the secret weapon.
It's the most underrated part of their business. The article says CPK is already in over 10,000 grocery stores. For many people in America, their primary interaction with the CPK brand isn't in a restaurant. It's in the freezer section at Kroger or Safeway. That consumer packaged goods, CPG business, is a steady, high-margin revenue stream that doesn't depend on leases or wait stuff.
It's their recording contract. The live shows at the restaurants are great for the brand and for connecting with fans. But the album sales from the frozen pizzas are what really pays the bills year-round.
That's a perfect way to think about it. And the new owners want to double down on that. Enhanced retail presence could mean more SKUs, better placement in stores, and pushing into new retailers like Costco or Target if they're not already there. This is where a firm like Consortium Brand Partners can really help, by bringing in CPG experts and using their relationships.
It's interesting, this multi-channel approach. It's like a musician who's not just playing live gigs, but also selling merchandise, licensing their music for commercials, and doing virtual concerts. CPK has the restaurants, the CPG business, and the article even mentions they're piloting vending machines in airports.
The vending machines are a fun little experiment. I don't know if that moves the needle financially, but it's a smart way to get the brand in front of a captive audience with disposable income. But the core challenge for the new owners is navigating the tension between the legacy restaurant business and the growing CPG business. The restaurants are what give the brand its authenticity and its premium feel. You can't just close them all down and focus on frozen pizza, because then you become just another faceless brand in the freezer.
You lose your soul. You lose the story. The story of those two prosecutors in Beverly Hills trying something new. That's what you're buying when you pick up that BBQ chicken frozen pizza. You're not just buying ingredients, you're buying a little piece of that California cool.
But managing a chain of over 120 restaurants in 10 countries is incredibly difficult and capital intensive. You have to deal with labor costs, food inflation, and fickle consumer tastes. My bet is that the new owners will use the franchise model to slowly de-risk the restaurant side of the business while pouring resources into the CPG side. The restaurants become, in essence, marketing hubs and R&D labs for the products that will be sold at scale in grocery stores.
So the live performance becomes the testing ground for the next hit record. They can try out a new pizza, a new song, on the menu in their restaurants. If it's a hit with the diners, they can then work on a frozen version to sell to the masses.
Precisely. That's the synergy they need to nail. But the risks are significant. Can they maintain quality and consistency as they expand the franchise footprint? Can they make the CPK brand feel relevant to Gen Z? Or is it destined to be a millennial and Gen X nostalgia brand? And in the frozen aisle, they're competing against giants like Nestle, who owns DiGiorno, and a proliferation of new artisanal frozen pizza brands.
It's a crowded stage. It comes back to the music itself. Is the core product, that California-style pizza, still a compelling offering? I think it is. They created a genre. Like a Thelonious Monk, their style was quirky and unexpected at first, but it became so influential that it's now part of the mainstream vocabulary. The challenge for the new bandleader isn't to write a whole new songbook, but to find that perfect new arrangement that respects the classic melody while making it sound fresh and exciting for 2026 and beyond.
I think that's the $300 million bet Consortium Brand Partners is making. They're betting that this classic tune still has legs, and that with a modern production, a better distribution strategy, and a tighter business model, they can turn it back into a chart topper. It's a fascinating turnaround story to watch, and a great counterpoint to the high-flying tech IPOs. It's a reminder that there's immense value still sitting in these iconic, tangible brick-and-mortar brands if you have the right strategy to unlock it.
Absolutely. From the public market's new headliners to a classic acts comeback tour, a perfect way to round out the episode.
All right, that brings us to the end of episode 12. We covered a lot of ground today, from the intense capital demands of AI to the disciplined, bootstrapped growth of an e-bike company.
We did. And as we close out, it feels like the two stories we just discussed really capture the dual narratives of the current moment. On one hand, you have the reopening of the IPO market, a stage for the next generation of innovators, with a clear demand from the audience for profitable, AI-driven performances.
And on the other hand, you have the story of California Pizza Kitchen, a reminder that value and opportunity don't just exist in the new and shiny. There's a whole world of established, beloved brands that are being reinvented with smart capital and modern playbooks, focusing on fundamentals like multi-channel revenue and brand licensing.
It's like a great jazz festival. You've got the explosive, high-energy new acts on the main stage. That's your IPO market. They're pushing the boundaries, and everyone's excited to see what they'll do next. But then, you've also got the masters playing the smaller, more intimate clubs, taking the classic standards we all know and love and reinterpreting them in beautiful, surprising new ways. That's your CPK story. Both are essential. Both are part of the same vibrant, ever-changing, and utterly captivating business landscape. It's all part of the music.
A perfect final note to end on, George.
Well, that is our time. A huge thank you to all of you for tuning in and lending us your ears. We hope you found the conversation as energizing as we did.
And a big thanks to our entire production team behind the scenes who make Startup Jazz happen every single week. We couldn't do it without them.
We'll be back next week with a whole new slate of stories, a new set list of startups, and more attempts to make sense of this beautiful, chaotic improvisation we call innovation. Until then, I'm George.
And I'm Michelle. Thanks for listening to Startup Jazz.
Keep swinging.
Desk stack high where the break room used to be. New faces walk in, but we can't name them yet, you see. Servers crash at 3 a.m., code spitting sparks. Customer chats pile up, we're missing all the marks. EMF's in hand, but the ship's losing steer. Higher ends a fire drill, we're flying blind, my dear. Cold sprints bleed to dawn, eyes heavy with the grind. Numbers climb so fast, but our nerves are right behind. Joy's in the climb, but the strain's in the bones. Every win's a question, will this house of cards hold? We laugh through the chaos, but the fear soft and low. Grows a wild horse, we're hanging on though.
Growing pains, sweet and sharp. Numbers soar, but our heads are in the dark. Chaos hums where the good times glow. Scared to fall, but we can't slow. Growing pains, tight and bright. We built the way, now we're fighting to ride. Happy's the dream, but the stress ain't gone. This is the rush, this is the storm. Board and docs are scribbled on a crumpled page. New hire asks, what's the plan? We just shrug, turn the page. Customer yells on the phone, your app's gone dead. Devs still at their desk, half asleep, half red. Cash flows up, but the team's running thin. Just one more week, we say, but the weeks keep pouring in. Whiteboards filled with to-dos that'll never get done. Gross a party, but we're all just hanging on. Joy's in the climb, but the strain's in the bones. Every win's a question, will this house of cards hold? We laugh through the chaos, but the fear's soft and low. Gross a wild horse, we're hanging on though. Growing pains, sweet and sharp. Numbers soar, but our heads are in the dark. Chaos hums where the good times glow. Scared to fall, but we can't slow. Growing pains, tight and bright. We built the wave, now we're fighting to ride. Happy's the dream, but the stress ain't gone. This is the rush, this is the storm. Like a half-remembered tune. Sax weaves tight like the knots in our room. We toast to the growth, but we whisper, please stay. To the calm we lost in the breakneck fray. Tired eyes meet, but we smile through the ache. Cause this mess is ours, this is the cake. Fear's a shadow, but joy's the light. Growing pains burn, but they feel so right. Growing pains, sweet and sharp. Numbers soar, but our hearts are in the park. Chaos hums where the good times glow. We'll stand tall, we won't slow. Growing pains, tight and bright. We built the wave, now we're learning to ride. Happy's the dream and the stress is part. This is the rush, this is our art.